Okay, welcome. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division for this last day of January already, January 31st. And we will have a quorum shortly, and then we will do the minutes. This is the last members of our series of overview hearings. Our committee has a lot jurisdiction over a lot of very major and important public entities. We reviewed MnDOT, we reviewed Met Council, the Department of Public Safety, and today we're going to be hearing from the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And we've allotted our first hour to their overview, and then we will hear from MnDOT. They have an aviation-related program that we want to be talking about, as well as their Greater Minnesota Transit operations. So for the overview, we have, is Mr. Killian here?
He stepped out just for a second.
Okay, so Mr. Ricks, you'll kick us off here. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. My name is Brian Ricks. I'm Executive Director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Thank you for inviting us here this afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I will provide an update. We'll talk a little bit about the Airports Commission from a governance standpoint. I'll get into some of the statistics. We'll talk about air service and some of the progress that we've made there over the last few years, get into some of our capital improvement projects, some of the major projects, and then certainly open it up for any questions. But again, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. A little bit about the Commission. We are a public corporation created by the state back in 1943, so we are we're celebrating our 75th anniversary this past year in 2018. We have three primary purposes: one, to promote efficient, safe, and economical air commerce. Really, we're responsible for developing the full potentials of aviation across the metropolitan area. We also are responsible for minimizing the environmental impacts through the work that we do, and we take that work very seriously, and I'll talk a little bit about our noise mitigation program that has been in effect for many, many years. We are able to own and operate airports within a 35-mile radius of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And we have a funding model that's really based on, if you do business at the airport or at one of our airports, there are fees that are paid. Or if you visit or use one of the facilities, there are fees that are paid that help pay for it. So it is a business type of an arrangement. We do not rely on any local tax dollars to support the operation. Our mission is connecting you to your world, and our vision is providing your best airport experience. We take that vision very seriously. We know that at Minneapolis and frankly any of the airports that individuals would fly into, it's the first impression of our state, of our Twin Cities area, and so we want to ensure that that is a first-class impression. We have a board of 15 commissioners. They're appointed by the governor, with the exception of the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Each have their own appointment, and they serve four-year terms. When this organization was set up 75 years ago, the legislature really had a lot of foresight. The governor had a tremendous amount of foresight to create an autonomous airports commission that's really solely focused on the operation of a system of airports. And that system works extremely well. We have commissioners that are dedicated to the cause, dedicated to the commission's mission and vision. Our commissioners serve four-year terms, so we do not have a wholesale change with a new governor, and that really, I think, works very well because we have many projects that extend over multiple years, and I'll talk about some of those later today, but it's good to have consistency as you're moving through those projects. The commission does meet monthly, and we have currently three different committees, a finance and administration, a planning development and environmental committee, and a management and operations committee. So they those committees vet the information out and prior to things coming to the full board. The Airports Commission in itself has 650 employees, and I'll give you a little comparison. There's about over 20,000 employees that work at the airport at Minneapolis on a daily basis. We operate much like a municipality with our own police, fire, dispatch, building inspection, planning and development areas, maintenance departments. Our staff are the ones that plow the runways on days like Sunday and Monday this past week. They mow the grass during the summertime. And again, our operation is funded by fees paid by airport users, not property taxes or income from other sources. I mentioned we do operate seven airports. The way the system was designed is that Minneapolis would be the airport that really would take on the scheduled air carrier and scheduled cargo traffic. And then we have six reliever airports, and those reliever airports are designed to take the pressure from a corporate and general aviation, small aircraft standpoint, take the pressure off of Minneapolis, and it works very, very well. We have currently about 1,115 daily takeoffs and landings at Minneapolis. We have just over 800 daily takeoffs and landings throughout our system of reliever airports. System works very well, and I think a good testament of that was a year ago this week when we had over 1,100 corporate jets descend down the Twin Cities area for the Super Bowl. And while I think there were about 400 of those at Minneapolis, all of the rest were contained at either St. Paul, Flying Cloud, or Anoka. So that it was a true testament of how well the system works to absorb that traffic. We'll see some of that activity coming up for the Final Four here in April as well, and we expect it. While we won't expect the volume of corporate jets, I believe there will be 600 to 700 corporate jets during that week as well. So it works very well. A little bit about our budget. From a revenue standpoint, we generate $381 million in annual revenues. About a third of that is parking and ground transportation revenue. We also generate about $127 million in the blue shaded area from airline rates and charges. Our landing fee, just to give you an example, is about $3 per 1,000 pounds. And to put that in perspective, so a Airbus 320, which Delta and many of the other airlines fly that aircraft in on a frequent basis, pays just over $500 to land at the facility. If you look at a Boeing 777, a wide-body, much larger international aircraft, that aircraft would pay about $1,700 to land on our runways in Minneapolis. So about $381 million in revenues. On the expenditure side, we expend about $198 million in expenses on an annual basis. Just under half of that is related to personnel. You can see we also have about 30.5 million of that expenditure is on operating contracts and expenses. About 20% of that, 198 million, is on maintenance. So it is a maintenance intensive facility. And then we're not making all that money. You can see by this chart, when you subtract those revenues or subtract the expenses from those revenues, we have net operating revenues of about $182 million, but we have something we have a debt service payment that is based on about $1.4 billion in annual debt service, and that annual debt service payment is and non-operating expense payment is about $122 million a year, which leaves about $59 million in net revenues. That's what we're projecting this year. Those net revenues are basically put back in to support capital improvements at Minneapolis and potentially our reliever airport system. So we take a very conservative approach to our financial model. We predicate it only on origination and destination passengers, meaning we don't have our financial model rely on connecting passengers. Currently, Delta, there's about 40% connecting passengers, where majority of those are Delta, where they fly into the hub, they get off an aircraft, get on another aircraft, and then fly on to another destination. We do maintain a six-month reserve, and we have a AA-minus bond rating, which is best in the airport industry, so we're proud of that. There's a handful of other airports that also share in that rating. From an air service perspective, our passenger levels this year in 2018, we just received these levels. We set another all-time record in total passengers, just over 38 million. You can see we were just over 38 million in 2017, so it's been a little bit more of a flat year. I think the other thing you can see by these numbers is that it rolls with the economy. When the economy is good, individuals travel. When the economy slows, travel seems to slow down. As far as our ranking amongst other major airports, the top 25 airports in the country, we are currently ranked 17th, just ahead of Detroit and just behind Boston. So about right in the middle of those major hub airports. I mentioned we've had tremendous success over the past couple of years, really from an air service perspective over the past 3 years. 11 different airlines have added a total of 45 additional routes at MSP, and we now enjoy competitive air service on 60 of our 167 direct nonstop routes to different locations, both domestic and internationally. So we're very proud of that. We invest in air service development. We incentivize airlines to invest in air service development here, on not unlike other major hub airports. And so we feel we have a very competitive program. Talk a little bit about some of the more recent examples of air service enhancements. Sun Country just announced a new round of expansion just a couple of weeks ago to 8 large cities. Sun Country, as you may know, is going through a transition from a low-cost to an ultra-low-cost carrier. A lot of that transition is to continue to grow in the Minneapolis, out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. So we're happy to see that. Again, 49 destinations. They are also entering into a mode where they're going to start connecting more passengers at Terminal 2, passengers that will be flying from the East Coast to the West Coast or vice versa. They'll have a lot of connections right here in the Twin Cities. JetBlue was the only major carrier that we had yet to have prior to May of last year in our market. They've added service now to Boston, 3 daily round trips to Boston. Boston is our 10th most popular destination out of the Twin Cities area. Over 700 people fly that route, and on that JetBlue service, they have access to about 20 additional East Coast destinations. Aer Lingus. Aer Lingus is our newest international carrier that will commence service on July 8th of this year. They will offer daily Boeing 757 service nonstop from here to Dublin. So we're very pleased that we'll have another international flag carrier in the market. From Dublin, passengers will be able to connect to over 30 other destinations all across Europe. Delta has also had some very nice announcements. They will be command Seoul service to Incheon Airport in Seoul beginning on April 1st of this year. That service is a joint venture with Korean Air, and with that joint venture, you'll be able to connect to 80-plus destinations across Asia. And they'll operate that service on Boeing 777 aircraft, obviously wide-body aircraft. That will be fantastic, a fantastic product for both business and leisure travelers.
Mr. Ricks, we have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a question for my own curiosity. Seoul is long distance away. Is that a straight-through, a one-stop flight? And that's got to be a long flight. Do you know approximately how long that is?
It is a straight-through, nonstop flight. I want to say it's got to be in the 15, 16-hour duration, somewhere in there.
Thanks.
Depending upon which direction you're going. But again, a fantastic opportunity to connect with many destinations across Asia. Another international service that they have announced that will launch on June 8th of this year is daily service to Mexico City, and again, very pleased with that additional international announcement. It's through a combination or agreement with Aeromexico, and you'll be able to connect to more than 40 other destinations in Mexico and Latin America. And then finally, from an international perspective, Delta has announced that it has applied to the U.S. Department of Transportation for permission to fly nonstop to Shanghai. Again, similar to Seoul, travelers will be able to connect to over 70 other destinations in China through Delta's agreement with China Eastern and Shanghai Airlines. So, if that is approved by the DOT, that service would begin in 2020 and also would be the first regularly scheduled service on their new Airbus A350 product, which if you haven't had a chance to fly in that aircraft, is just a fantastic, fantastic aircraft. So all in all, with the addition of Aer Lingus, we now have 17 different carriers operating out of Minneapolis. It's a good variety of network carriers, full-service network carriers such as Delta, American, and United, low-cost carriers such as Southwest, JetBlue, Alaska, and ultra-low-cost carriers such as Spirit, Frontier, and Sun Country. So we feel that we've got a fantastic array of airlines that serve the entire traveling public, regardless of whether you're a business traveler and want a high-quality product or a leisure traveler that wants to just get somewhere for as little expense as possible. One of the reasons we've been successful, I think, in air service development is that our costs remain very low. This is a metric called cost per in-plane passengers, and you can see how we rate with many other airports in the country, the top 28 airports in the country. We are in the bottom quarter of that with our cost per in-plane passenger at $6.83. And this metric is really determined by adding up all the costs for the airlines to operate in Minneapolis and dividing that out by the number of passengers that are served. And so we're really proud of this. We've been in this area for many, many years. We're going to continue to stay in that area because it is a competitive advantage when we go out and seek new service. And we're especially proud when you look, I think, above us on that list. There's probably eight or nine airports that don't have expense in snow removal like we do, and so we certainly feel good in that fashion. One of the other reasons that we've been successful with air service development is we, in 2017, we started a partnership with Greater MSP. And this partnership has brought together 26 of our largest companies, including our Fortune 500 companies, to really gain more information about where these companies need to get to. And through that effort, we have surveyed them, we have brought compiled information, and we've brought that information back to airlines to help help us sell new route opportunities. And I can tell you the Dublin service, the Seoul service, the Shanghai, and the Mexico City service this information was critical in landing those new service opportunities. So it's a collaborative effort. We know airlines want to hear from our business travelers, and we've brought them into this this partnership to ensure that we are being proactive in developing new routes.
Mr. Ricks, we have a question from Representative Cagle.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ricks, this is this might be a good spot to ask this question. I have the Anoka County Airport in my district, and some of the my constituents were talking about the increased traffic up there, especially from some of the manufacturers or businesses, larger planes coming in. Can you speak to that a little bit? Is that a trend that's going on? And I'd heard, too, a rumor about lengthening runways at Anoka. Is that something that's in the works as well?
Mr. Ricks?
Chair Hornstein and Representative, we haven't seen a big increase in the volume of traffic up there, honestly. I mean, it is one of our airports that has grown over the years. During the Super Bowl, we certainly saw much more corporate traffic. As far as extending the runway, we are not allowed to extend that runway, and that's based on state statute. The maximum length is 5,000 feet, and that's as far as we can go on it, unless the legislature were to take action that would allow or permit that runway to be extended beyond that point. So right now, we do not have plans to do that. There are, I would say, there, as you know, there's property around that airport for development. There's quite a few hangars around that facility. But we have not seen an inordinate amount of growth there over the last few years. I can get you more specifics at a future date if you'd like as well.
Thank you. And also just wanted to congratulate you on the national shout-out about the bathrooms at Minneapolis St. Paul Airport from Gail King. That was quite the fun little story there.
Mr. Ritt.
Chair Hornstein, Representative, thank you for that. We appreciate that. That's an award that we're very proud of. We know that our passengers want good first-class bathrooms, and we certainly invested in that. We're not through with that program yet. We have a number more to do, but every month you're seeing more of those come online. So,
thank you. Proceed.
Absolutely. You know, one of the other things that we've been involved with very closely with Meet Minneapolis and Visit St. Paul and frankly all of our destination marketing organizations is to bring major events to the Twin Cities. The Super Bowl was a great example of that. We were challenged by the Super Bowl. We had never experienced that many individuals. And it wasn't the incoming traffic that really we were concerned about. It was the outgoing traffic because we knew everybody wanted to get out of town the day after that event. And we typically put between 35 and 45,000 passengers through TSA screening each and every day. And on that particular day, it was close to 62,000 passengers. But I will say that TSA performed wonderfully. They initiated some new programs here that really helped move that traffic along. So what it did was certainly demonstrate that we can accommodate major, major events in this community, and the airport is not going to be anything that would restrict us to bring individuals in. Ryder Cup was another example, not the volume, but over 3,000 golf bags went through security the day after the Ryder Cup, and what that told us is that people just didn't come to watch the event. They came to golf as well, which was certainly good for our economy. And currently we're gearing up for Final Four. Again, not as big of a push, but certainly a very significant event from a passenger standpoint and corporate jet activity that will be coming through our facilities.
We have a question from Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, maybe it's more of just a comment. I'm going to do a little bragging on my part of the state and its participation with the Super Bowl because the St. Cloud Airport acted as a huge corporate reliever for the MAC to be able to do as much as they did and to be as efficient as we're hearing today. There was millions of dollars worth of corporate jets that landed in that airport, and it is a fully functional airport with TSA to be able to expedite people. And the trip from Highway 10 or I-94 is not very far when you're coming from other parts across the country when you talk about your commute. And I had heard a lot of positives from the people that ran the St. Cloud Airport and people who were involved in that, and the local MAC representative from that area, Patty Gartland, and I are not only friends, but have worked professionally together. And Patty keeps me posted on a lot of the things that happen in your organization, as well as how well St. Cloud performed as a partner with you, and I'm assuming other reliever airports in the area also help with that. So it's more a comment than it is anything, since we're doing some bragging here today. So I thought I would just get my fair share's worth. So
well, and while thank you very much, Representative Driscoll, and while we're at the St. Cloud, on the topic of the St. Cloud Airport, it is something that, you know, those of us who live near MSB have always felt that St. Cloud, you know, could use some more service. And what is the current situation? I think United had some flights there at one time. Or is there are there major carriers flying in and out of St. Cloud at this point?
Chair Hornstein, Representative O'Driscoll, thank you for the comments. As you may know, formerly managed the St. Cloud Airport in a previous life, and also the Duluth International Airport for 10 years. So I know how valuable those airports are across the state, and we reach out on a regular basis to support however we can. Having been at smaller airports, those two airports in particular, for 15 years, when there was scheduled air service, I know firsthand how critical that service is to those communities and the ability to develop and promote a continued economic growth throughout them. We had Northwest AirLink when I was there, 6 flights daily to the Twin Cities. Unfortunately, that service was discontinued a number of years ago. Currently, they have Allegiant Airlines. Allegiant is a ultra-low-cost carrier that's really focused on the leisure traveler. We did have Allegiant when I was in Duluth as well, going to Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Orlando while I was there, but that's the current state of air service. I know we also, Commissioner Gartland, through the St. Cloud Downtown Development Corporation, was heading up a study to look at St. Cloud and what the future of that airport should be in the coming years. And I believe that study is just coming out. I know that, I know you, the legislature, put some money into that. We appreciate that. But again, those airports are tremendous assets in those communities, and we are very supportive of doing what we can to help grow air service. I know when Duluth did a small community air service application, we signed a letter of support. We've been down to Rochester supporting some of the development that they're doing there as well, and we'll continue to do that because we know that regardless of whether those airlines are flying out of Minneapolis or St. Cloud or Duluth or Rochester or Hibbing or Brainerd, that helps promote our state and the economic opportunities in our state as a whole. So we'll continue to be very supportive.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely. I'm going to change gears a little bit on sustainability to just talk a little bit about some of the things we're doing in that regard. I think many of you know that we've had a long history, I think, of noise insulation program in the Twin Cities area. We've been invested nearly $500 million on mitigating or insulating over 15,000 homes, 3,300 multifamily units, and 19 schools. So we are committed to that program. We are currently still operating that program under a something called a consent decree that basically if and we measure our noise contours on an actual basis, on an actual annual basis, if those contours extend additional homes and a home is within that contour extension for three consecutive years, we will go out and mitigate that home as well. So it's still a very, very active program. A little bit about the operations at Minneapolis. Last year there were just over 407,000 annual aircraft landings and takeoffs, and as I said, it accounts to just over 1,116 per day. We've actually, when we compare that number with our peak number back in 2004, which was 541,000 annual operations, that's about 367 less takeoffs and landings at Minneapolis-St. Paul International than there were back in 2004. So our passenger numbers continue to climb somewhat. Operations go down, and so you say, how can that work? Well, the way it works is that airlines are investing in larger aircraft to serve the market, and they're phasing out some of those smaller aircraft. So it's been a good program for the traveler because it really integrates a better product from an airline standpoint into the market. A little bit about reducing our carbon footprint. As you've probably heard, we have installed two of the largest solar arrays on the tops of our parking structures, both at Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. That program to help reduce our carbon emissions, that program is working very well. It's basically paying for all the lighting and the electrical use in those parking structure complexes. We've also added a green roof at Terminal 2. We've also done things like gate electrification so that airlines don't have to run auxiliary power units at the gate, again, reducing carbon emissions. We have an electric vehicle fleet program where we're integrating electric vehicles into our fleet every day. So it's, again, we're very focused on sustainability, and we'll continue to do that as we move forward. I'm going to move into some of our major construction projects that have been completed over the past couple of years. First one I'll talk about is the hotel. The new Intercontinental Hotel opened in July of this year. It's developed and managed by Graves Hospitality. Graves built the hotel. We supplied, obviously, the property. The hotel, we charged them with a ground lease. But we also built a connecting skyway from the hotel over to Concourse C so that there's easy access for passengers that are coming and going from the hotel and flying out or vice versa. That hotel also has about 30,000 square feet of meeting and conference space, and so it's a very nice asset. As you know, many other major airports have hotels located right on them, and we're very proud of this new facility that we have here at MSP. You may have also noticed, if you've flown through the facility recently, that we have been renovating concessions. Just prior to the Super Bowl, we completed a first phase of our concessions renovation, adding 50 new food and beverage news and retail outlets to the facility. Once the Super Bowl was over, we entered into a second phase where we're adding another 30 new concessions opportunities at the facility. Again, our focus is on when individuals fly through this airport, we want them to get a sense of what the Twin Cities and Minnesota is all about by showing off local concessions. And so we have a number of local concessionaires that are really doing great things and winning awards through that concessions program. Another major project is what we term our terminal operations improvements. And basically what we're doing is we're taking and we're adding 16 feet to the front of Terminal 1. There's not a lot of space there to add that additional square footage. But we're going to add that all along that that front roadway. We opened the first phase of that during the Super Bowl, or just before the Super Bowl, and that additional square footage made a tremendous difference for getting those 62,000 passengers back through the terminal and through the facility the day that they departed. So we're pushing that front wall out. We're completely redoing the vertical circulations elements, the elevators and escalators through there. We're improving sight lines. We're adding more natural colors. We're really upgrading the ticketing level, the baggage claim level, which is kind of the dark, dingy area of the terminal, and all of that vertical circulation, those vertical circulation elements. We're going to have a major, I think it's the largest public art piece of any public building in Minnesota. There's going to be a hole cut through the floor between ticketing and baggage to kind of open that up, and there's going to be a major art piece displayed in that area. Again, the focus of these improvements, which is about a $400 million project over about a six-year period, is to provide a consistent experience once individuals get off the aircraft and transition through the facility to parking or ground transportation or vice versa. And we know we will accomplish that with this program.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ricks, is there any plans for upgrading Terminal 2 at all?
The Terminal 2?
Yeah.
Mr. Hornstein and Representative, we have been upgrading Terminal 2. In 2016, we added four additional gates to that terminal. We are currently looking at additional gate expansion over the coming years based on Sun Country's growth plan. So, yes, there is. We're continuing to do some minor upgrades in that facility as well this year. I should also say that facility currently has 14 gates and can be expanded out to 32 gates. So there's a lot of room for expansion. We have Terminal 1 and Terminal 2, which is really a good model, I think, for a major hub airport in that a number of our low-cost carriers are over at Terminal 2. With low-cost carriers, you typically have more leisure travelers as well. So what's nice about Terminal 2, it's really easy to get in and out of. And so it's a very nice complementary terminal. There's about, of the 38 million passengers that go through Minneapolis, about 5.5 to 6 million passengers go through Terminal 2 currently, to give you a little sense of the scope.
And I guess, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ricks, I was just wondering, too, if of these 80 new shops and restaurants, if any of those are over in Terminal 2, because I know that's a little limited over there.
They are, yeah, a good question. Thank you. They are, and there will be more. We'll be adding more opportunities over at Terminal 2 as well in the coming year. So, absolutely.
Continue.
All right, a few more slides here. The Silver Parking Ramp is another major project that we have embarked on, and the reason we've began that project just over a year ago, about a year and a half ago, is because we typically run out of parking on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at Terminal 1. This is a new 5,000-space parking ramp that will also include auto rental facilities and a transit facility for buses, and that facility will open in 2020. The good thing about moving rental cars a little bit further out to this facility is it will open up more close-in parking for regular travelers as well.
Yes, Vice Chair Tapney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I came here to the legislature, I was on the Transportation Advisory Board, and at that meeting they talked a lot about the future of that parking ramp as we look at future transportation patterns and self-driving cars and things like that.
Absolutely.
What are the plans for that ramp as we look out into the future as driving patterns change?
Yeah. Mr. Rick. Chair Hornstein and Vice Chair Tapke, it's a very good question, because people say, why are you adding 5,000 spaces when you know the future, as you said, are autonomous vehicles and other modes of transportation? And frankly, the other impact that we've seen is probably the biggest I don't want to call it really a disruptor, but a change in our industry has been the advent of the transportation network companies, the Ubers and Lyfts, and the trips that individuals are taking to get to the facility. The commission studied this very long and hard with some of those factors in place, and decided that we felt we still needed to build this facility. One, we needed to satisfy our current demand, and we think that demand is going to continue to be there for a number of years yet. But secondly, one of the biggest, as I'm sure you've experienced, one of our biggest challenges is curb frontage in front of Terminal 1. And during real peak times, depending upon whether it's an arrival or a departure rush, if it's an arrival rush, things will really back up on that baggage level area. If it's a departure rush, it'll back up going to the upper level. We have two ramps. Those two closest ramps house about 6,000 parking spots. And so what we are looking at is those ramps are, 40 to 50 years old right now, or approaching that. And eventually we will either need to refurbish those ramps or tear them down and rebuild. But that will give us an opportunity to look at what the demand is, whether we need additional curb frontage for TNCs or the impact on autonomous vehicles. So we're looking at that very closely. So again, we feel confident that even with some of those changes, this ramp was needed. It will be needed for long term, and that we've got some variables in there that will allow us to adapt if need be. The other thing I would say is there are some off-site parking locations, one in Bloomington, one in St. Paul, and we know that those communities may eventually have different, better uses for those sites as well. So I think combined, there's 5,000 or 6,000 spaces between those facilities as well. So we feel that we're preparing for the future, not only with the new ramp, but we've got some options that will allow us to really address some of the other issues as they come down.
Thank you.
Absolutely. This gives you just a little picture of what the site looked like, and to orientate you, that towards the top of the screen is the inbound roadway coming in along Concourse C. And the outbound roadway used to be right there, too, just parallel to that inbound roadway. On the left part of the screen was our former exit plaza coming out of the parking structure. That building in the left third of the page, or left half of the page, is the U.S. Post Office. So what we had to do, that parking structure really went right where the exit plaza currently is. So we had to build a new exit plaza first, which is down to the right of the screen, kind of where that aircraft is parked along the Delta hangar there. And the hotel went in just to the right of the post office. So I'll fast forward to what it looked like in November of this year, and you can really see the change in the site. This parking structure there on the left side, the post office still in the middle. The hotel gives you a good sense of where the hotel is located, and the skyway over to Concourse C. The future plan, if you look at down to the left corner of the page, you see the Delta aircraft parked at the end of Concourse G. We can always extend that concourse further down, and if that Concourse G is extended further down to add additional gates, that skyway will then continue over to Concourse G. So again, a very convenient, accessible hotel to the passengers flying in and out of the facility. Just a little bit about economic impact, and I think that will wrap it up. We did an analysis back in 2017, or I should say it was released in 2017. It was based on 2016 data that indicated the MSP generates almost $16 billion in total economic impact. Close to 87,000 jobs are associated with the airport operation, about $3.7 billion in employee earnings, $973 million in taxes generated. And then we also unveiled a study just last year about our reliever airports, That indicated about $750 million of economic impact associated with those that reliever system, over 1,000 jobs and $56 million in direct wages. So a tremendous economic impact for airports. I always say that airports are economic engines, and I think that's a good example of that impact. We're also, as I said, we're focused on customer service, and I can tell you that we are very proud to have been rated the number one airport between 15 and 40 million passengers both in 2016 and 2017. We haven't heard yet on the results of 2018, but we're hopeful maybe we can get three in a row. And then also the most efficient airport in North America by Air Transport Research Society, which is a group of educators, college educators, that really get together and they analyze the efficiency of airports, the cost structures, the costs for airlines to do business and tenants to do business, and again, rated number one in both 2017 and 2018. There's a number of other accolades we've received that we're very proud of, again, as I said, we're just really focused on that customer element, ensuring that your first and last impression of Minnesota and the Twin Cities region is a positive one. So we've got some more construction to still get through, but once we get through this operational improvements program, the parking facility, I think you'll really recognize this facility, this airport is, and our system of airports is first class. So that's the extent of my presentation.
Thank you for that. I have a question, but I wanted to first call on Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for being with us today. You mentioned arrival congestion. Do our airports have any plans for cell phone waiting type areas that they have at some airports?
Chair Hornstein and Representative Perkelson, we do actually. We have a cell phone waiting lot on Post Road right now. It's kind of, we located it there because it was kind of between Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. So there is a lot there. I think it probably has maybe 40 to 50 locations. And during busy times, it does get filled up, but there is a cell phone waiting lot at the facility.
Because Mr. Chair, coming into Terminal 2 there's a tendency for people to park along that street.
Right.
And then get chased away by the airport police. Not that this would ever happen to me personally, but one more question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. I can remember back when there was talk of moving a major airport further out of the metropolitan area. Hastings, I think, was one of the sites mentioned at the time. Are we well beyond that we feel we can handle the growth that the region needs to accommodate at the current site? I mean, you're investing a lot of money there. Seems to be working pretty well. What's your take on that?
Mr. X.
Chair Hornstein, Representative. I think that's a very good question. I mentioned that our operation takeoff and landing numbers are down. It's 367 daily arrivals and departures from what they were at our peak. Since that time, we've also added a north-south a runway, so it's brought in more capacity. So we feel pretty good about the ability for this airport to continue to operate and be able to absorb additional capacity as demand dictates. And it's not only about the airfield configuration, it's about ramp areas, it's about numbers of gates. As I mentioned, we have gate expansion opportunities both at Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. I think our biggest challenges are the congestion I talked about, inbound, outbound roadways and those things, and we talked about some of the things that we're looking at there. What I will say in regard to that is we're just getting ready to embark on an updated long-term comp plan or master plan for the airport. Part of that process will be to do a demand and capacity analysis to really look at what the forecasted growth is anticipated to be over the next 20 to 25 years, and really determine whether this facility can continue to accommodate that.
Thank you. I have a question, then we'll go to Representative Heinrich and then Representative Mason. It's actually related to the slide just before your last slide. You mentioned 86,900 jobs. That's sort of like a small city. And so I want sort of a two-part question. You know, a lot of attention has been paid to the fact that many of these jobs, and maybe you could tell me how many of them are minimum wage jobs, and they're, my understanding, you contract with third parties. Do you know how many of these jobs are minimum wage jobs?
Chair Hornstein, I don't right off the top of my head. I think what I can tell you is, as you may recall, back in 2015, the MAC did increase the minimum wage out there, a dollar over the state minimum wage, right, for service workers. I want to just clarify to you that 86,000 jobs are not the jobs at the airport. That's jobs that are impacted by the airports, the people that work offsite. We have
right,
about 20, just over 20,000 jobs at the site. So that wage ordinance was added. So anytime the state wage increases, that wage does increase for service workers, such as aircraft fuelers, cleaners, folks preparing meals, ramp, gate agents, baggage handlers are all under that increase in minimum wage. So we're currently over the state minimum wage. When I know about a year ago we did a survey, and during that survey of those workers, roughly 3,300 workers, and about 35% were at that increased minimum wage, a dollar over. 65% were above it, and 25% were above $15. And that was about, I think that was January of last year when we took a look at that.
Thank you for that. That's very helpful. You know, the reason I said small city is that, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul have increased the wage to 15, okay, phased in. And it sounds like you have done that in the past, and the MAC does have the ability to do that with these contractors. It's under your governance, you could require that these contractors, for example, could go up to a $15 wage if you chose to do that.
That is my understanding. We're looking into that right now. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, there's been a lot of discussion amongst our current commissioners about doing that, given the Minneapolis and St. Paul minimum wages. And so the first thing that we are doing, we're actually waiting for an audit report from our internal auditors to give us a read on our new concessions, first phase concessions program, and how those workers are both paid, and comparing the benefit packages of those workers as well.
Thank you. And then just also one last jobs-related question. And we just had the government shut down, and it's possible we would have another one. So how was the airport impacted? I was aware that, you know, some pilots and flight attendants had and other places had raised safety concerns. We had TSA issues here. I understand that we were among the laggards in terms of wait times because of shortage of TSA personnel. What's your take now? Are there any lessons learned from this government shutdown, in case there is another one in a couple of weeks?
Mr. Chair, thank you for asking that. And I want to clarify something. In fact, just in the Business Journal I saw the other day that it said Minneapolis had 45-minute wait times. I want to clarify. That was peak. That was a peak wait time at a certain period during the day. When you look at the average, and that peak was, I believe, early in the morning when the big demand of outgoing traffic was. But the average was 15 minutes, and that was standard security screening. TSA pre-check was much less than that. There were also reports that
TSA employees were calling in sick. We really didn't experience that here much at all. What happened was TSA employees were told that they could not take time off. They could not take vacation time. So at times they did have to call in because of prearranged doctor appointments and things like that. So I think that was put a little bit out of perspective. The greatest impact we saw, frankly, that drove some of those peak wait times were Minnesotans were so keyed into this and focused on, you know, if you were going south during this time of the year, you want to make sure you don't miss that flight and you're on it. They were showing up much earlier than was typical. And the way TSA operates is they get demand schedules from the airlines, and then they bring employees in to accommodate that demand, figuring individuals will show up an hour and a half to 2 hours before that flight. They saw much bigger volumes of individuals showing up 2 to 2.5, sometimes 3 hours before flights, which really forced those wait times early during those times. And so that's what was happening. But we were very concerned about those TSA employees. The airport's commission and our staff implemented a number of measures. So you may have saw that we had the Salvation Army out there providing assistance. We had meals. We had worked with our concessionaires on discount programs. We had a gift card program as well. And I will say this, the TSA personnel that did not get paid for a number of weeks performed just outstanding for us at that facility.
Great. Thank you. So we have Representative Heinrich, we have Representative Mason, Representative Bernardi, and if there's no one else, I have one last question for you, but let's go with our members first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, I just had a question about, you mentioned about the Sun Country Airlines moving from a low-cost to an ultra-low-cost carrier, which sounds good to me, especially this time of year. What exactly does that mean? What's a carrier go through? Is there changes in, is there equipment overhaul, or is it just a matter of fact that there's more destinations now, and so they're able to stretch costs a little better? If you could just chat about that, it'd be great.
Sure. Chair Hornstein and Representative, it's a number of things. One, obviously going from a low-cost to an ultra-low-cost carrier, they have really been focused on reducing the operating costs of the airline wherever possible and increasing, obviously, the revenues from the daily operation. So one of the things they did is reconfigure the aircraft. So they got rid of their first class aircraft so that they could get another roughly 20 seats on those aircraft. So they have done that. They are also going through updating their reservation system to make it more cost effective as well, integrating advanced technology to make it easier for the consumer to do that. They have looked at their complete operation from a we call it above and below wing, the people that, like the gate agents that work with the customers and integrate with the customers on a daily basis, the individuals that are putting bags into the aircraft and so forth, they have contracted that service out now, so it's not Sun Country employees. They've contracted that out to save costs as well. So those are some, I think, examples of what they're doing. They're trying to make more efficient use of their gate space, meaning generating more turns for each gate, which will drive down those gate costs as well. So those are some of the things. It's really focused on reducing those costs, putting in place a model that, as a consumer, you can click on their website and buy the most reasonable fare to a destination that you want, but then giving you the choice on whether you want to pay for a bag that you're going to check or a carry-on bag. So that's the difference in the model that they've incorporated there. Similar to Spirit Airlines, sure. Similar to Frontier Airlines as well.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At a recent national conference, I was talking with a woman, and she has some health issues, and she was complaining that at some of the airports it's really difficult to get the help that you need. And at both of Lindbergh and Humphrey airports, I've always been impressed with how friendly the staff is and how they are always ready to help. So
thank you.
Just, you know, pass that on. It's really impressive.
Chairman Hornstein, Representative Mason, thank you for that comment. We do focus on that. In fact, we have a group. It's called our TDAC, the Travelers with Disabilities Advisory Committee, that we bring in representatives of those special groups to really focus on how we can make their transition through our facilities the best it possibly can be. Example of what we integrated just last year was a program called IRA. We're partnering with a company called IRA that helps. It's a program where you can put glasses or you have an app that helps guide you through our facilities. And we, as a commission, we pay for that service so that when someone lands, they can put these glasses in on that help guide them, and they're connected to an individual on a line that can actually see for them and guide them through those facilities. The other thing I just really need to shout out that I think makes us unique is we have an airport foundation made up of over 400 volunteers that are not paid, that come to this airport day in and day out and provide service and answer questions. And those individuals are at information booths, and they're also roaming through the facility looking for people that need help. And frankly, those are some of the reasons why we've been voted number one airport in the past few years. So thank you.
Okay, I have one. Anyone else says I have one last question, but I want to defer to the committee if anyone else. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here. Can you comment just briefly about, I got a letter from, I'm not going to say the name right, but it's like the Armed Services Force and their expansion there. I don't think I heard some comments on that, but if you could just share that with the committee.
Mr. Rick.
Chair Hornstein and Representative, thank you for bringing that up as well. We have an active Armed Forces Services Center at the facility. I think the downside to that facility right now is it's pre-security, so that when there's veterans or active military individuals coming through the facility, they have to go outside of screening and then come back in. I should have mentioned, as part of this operational improvements program, we are building a whole new space for them, a much larger space that's going to be post-security, so that'll be much more accessible. And those facilities are accessible for not only the individuals, but their family members, and it's a great volunteer service that we have out at Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. That's the last question. So I represent an area that, of course, has had over many years noise impacts, and from time to time I hear from constituents about, you know, access to meetings and the number of public meetings. Do you still have to go through security to get to the NAC meetings at this point?
Chair Hornsey, you still do, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then I think at one time I had a bill related to that, and I think it passed, but we kind of made an agreement that, that occasionally, and I don't know if it was once a year, but on occasion you would have meetings in the community rather than at the airport boardroom where you have to go through security. Are those happening? Do you still have do you have board meetings, outside of the airport so people wouldn't have to go through security?
Yeah, Chair Hornstein, since I've been here, I don't recall that we've had a commission meeting outside of the commission chambers, which is post-security. We've had many public hearings. I know when we were working through the taxi TNC ordinance, we did have public hearings outside specifically to accommodate the large volumes of individuals. But I'll take that back and take a closer look at that.
And just
that.
One last question related. You know, the last sort of engagement that I think a lot of people had was with the long-term capital plan, and I believe there were some hearings that were, you didn't have to go through security. It was at your old facility or the old MAC board facility at 28th Avenue.
Right.
Where are we at in terms of public involvement with that planning process? And I know, I think another plan will be released in 2022. Are there, you know, still some commitments and public engagement related to that long-term plan that are out there still?
Chair Hornstein, absolutely. We are going to be kicking off a very large public engagement effort as part of that, putting together a regional advisory stakeholder group as well. One of the things that I've really been focused on, and our commission, frankly, has been focused on, is engagement. We've added, that was added to our strategic plan just before I came in here, and I certainly support that, and so we'll continue to be very engaged in our communities. The other thing I should have said in reference to the meetings as well is the Noise Oversight Committee, which I think you know is a group of six communities around the airport and also six user representatives, and we have we have FAA involved in that group as well to really get together and study noise and are there things that we can continue to look at or continue to do to help mitigate the noise issue. Those meetings are held at the 28th Avenue, our general office is on 28th Avenue, and we do hold public outreach meetings on a quarterly basis, and we alternate those meetings at the MAC facility versus out in the community. So we are continuing to do that.
Well, thank you very much for a very informative overview, and thank you, members, for all of your questions. We went a little bit over time on this, so hopefully for our last two presentations we can have those a little bit condensed. We'll first hear from MnDOT. I don't know if you want to do aviation first or greater aviation. So we're on the roll here with aviation members. While we're going through this transition, we do now have a quorum, and so Representative Petersburg, motion on the minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the minutes of the January 29th meeting.
Representative Petersburg moves approval of the minutes from the January 29th meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. So a couple of MnDOT issues that we didn't get to in their overview that I think are particularly important, so we're calling them back. And of course, we didn't get to everything. We didn't get to every single transportation issue in the state by way of an overview, and there's still a few more out there that we'll do from time to time. But this is, again, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is kind of our conclusion. But because aviation outside of the MAC system is so important, we wanted to have a little bit of time for that. And, of course, we talked about Metro Transit earlier in the month, and so we're going to end with a little bit on Greater Minnesota Transit. So we have about 20 minutes left for those presentations, and maybe if you could do them in 15, then we can set aside 5 minutes for member questions.
Sure.
Please welcome to the committee. Thank Please you. State your name for the record.
My name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for MnDOT, and I just have a few slides for you, and I'll go through them quickly, but feel free to just ask questions as we go. The first slide is to talk to you really about airports from Halleck to Caledonia, Pipestone, Grand Marais, and everything in between. So the state system of airports, there's 133 public airports in Minnesota that almost all are owned by cities across the state. Of those airports, they're different sizes, shapes, all those kinds of things. You can see there on the map. One of the important things to know with that first map that's coming up, you would have it in your packets. So when you look at that, the airports that are red, they are eligible for federal funding. There's the Airport Improvement Program provides federal funds to airports. The airports in blue do not receive federal funding. They only receive state funding. And then, of course, all of them participate at the local level as well. Your next slide there talks a little bit about ownership of airports. One of the things that I think most people, when they think airport, they think MSP. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But the reality is that over half of the airports in Minnesota are owned by a city with a population less than 5,000 people. And to give you some context, though, those small airports are very important to those communities. We heard from the MAC about jobs and economy and things like that. I'll use Elbow Lake, Minnesota, as an example. City with a population less than 1,200 people, there's 12 full-time jobs at the airport. That's a lot of jobs in a town of 1,200 people. It matters to that community, and we work hard with them every day to help them make their airport successful. The very next slide that you'll see is a little bit about how we spend money and where it goes. So there's a state airports fund. There's four sources of revenue that goes into the state airports fund: aviation fuel taxes, sales tax on aircraft, aircraft registration tax, which would be similar to a license tab, except the aircraft registration tax is much higher than a license tab fee would be. And then there's a fourth tax called the airline flight property tax. And that tax serves as a shock absorber for the state airports fund. It's connected to the appropriation level. The way we spend that dollar, we send this flyer out when we send our tax bills to the folks who own airplanes in the state so they can see where their aviation taxes are going. 70% of the money goes straight to the airports in the form of grants for either capital projects, so a runway extension, a hangar, those kinds of things. A component of that money also goes for maintenance and operations. And so that's the utility bills at the airport. That's the salary of the city snowplow driver while he's plowing the runway, those kinds of things. So the state participates financially with all of those airports. 10% go to navigation systems. I think no matter where you are in Minnesota, you've been a beneficiary, particularly this last week, of some of that. Every time you hear the temperature at the airport is, that's almost always equipment that we, MnDOT Aeronautics, own, operate, and maintain for the system. So we own a system of navigational aids, including the automated weather observation stations across the state that provide for air navigation. We're actually that participation, we're the largest, what they would call, non-fed state in the country in terms of our participation in that. We do safety inspection. We have a broad regulatory role in aviation. I mentioned that we're a tax collector. We also, not only do we license and inspect airports, we license commercial operators in aviation, so flight schools, aircraft mechanics, those kinds of things. We also have education component that we do. We partner with the University of Minnesota for the Airport Technical Assistance Program, so we provide funding to do continuing education of airport personnel statewide. So that's just a quick overview. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions about Greater Minnesota non-MAC aviation. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cities with population less than 5,000 or 1,000, you cited Elbow Lake, and it's good for their economy and 12 jobs, and that they're eligible for federal funds. Are there state funds going there too?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. And so the way it works, there's two things. One are our maintenance and operations grants. So every public airport in the state, except for MSP, the other MAC airports, but MSP doesn't receive maintenance and operations. So they all receive an annual grant, and it's a formula based on the infrastructure at the airport. So they receive that for maintenance and operations. And then when they have a capital project, if they're a federal airport, FAA participates at 90%, and then 10% is state and local. And we put in 5%, so it's 90 federal, 5 state, 5 local for capital projects. The splits usually never work out that cleanly. There's often items that are not federally eligible, so we participate in those as well.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up.
Representative Hausman.
I guess the question I have is, I mean, at a certain point, you have to wonder what's the need in a small town. Mm-hmm. I mean, beyond 12 jobs, what's the traffic, and when does it warrant taxpayer subsidy? How much subsidizing for how much air traffic?
Mr. Chair, this really up to the City Council. So City Councils decide if they're going to have an airport or not. We collect the aviation taxes and distribute those back out to the system. There are City Councils that decide their airport is no longer viable. We actually have closed two airports this year, one just a couple of months ago. That particular city, they needed to relocate their water tower, and they made a different choice. But most communities, the vast majority that we work with, the airport is the reason that certain businesses in town are there. If the airport's not there, the business goes to another town that has one, because so many businesses use aviation as part of their model. They're either moving parts or equipment or technicians or things like that. And so state law tells us the size of the system, the size is smaller. What we support today is smaller than what state law allows. And so if a city chooses aviation, it's our job to help them make it successful.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, so we wouldn't make any independent judgment if state taxpayer dollars are flowing there. It's totally, as long as a city wants to keep its airport open, we just keep sending state taxpayer money?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, and those tax dollars that we're sending are aviation taxes. So it's taxes collected from aviation users and sent back. So it's not general fund money. We operate within MnDOT. We're sort of an agency inside the agency in terms of funding. Pays all the aviation activities come from those aviation taxes.
Thank you. Ms. Nill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for our record.
Sure. Chair, committee members, my name is Victoria Nill, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Office of Transit and Active Transportation. Although active transportation is part of the office, I am going to focus today on Greater Minnesota Public Transit. All right. So MnDOT is responsible for supporting transit in all 80 counties outside the metro area. We have 25 county or multi-county transit providers, five small urban transit providers serving populations from 2,500 up to 50,000. We have seven urbanized transit providers that provide service in cities of 50,000 up to 200,000. And then we have six tribal transit providers. Now, MnDOT does do the support and guidance on the tribal transit providers, but they do receive their funding directly from the FTA. All right, so the benefits of a great transit network. We have economic opportunity, quality of life, health, air quality, and community connections. Now, to get to these benefits, we have some strategic direction. We want to provide an attractive and viable transit option for Greater Minnesota, improve the coordination of services, increase transit usage, ensure fiscal responsibility, and support an integrated multimodal system. So in 2009, the legislation told us to prepare a Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan. And in that plan, we were to identify the need for public transit, create a plan to meet that need, calculate the cost of meeting 100% of that transit need, and then set a goal to meet 90% of the transit need by the year 2025. This plan was most recently updated in late 2017 and early 2018. In addition, the transit systems are preparing their five-year plans that will implement strategies at the local level. During the community output, or the community input portion of updating the plan, these are the themes that we heard. They would like longer service hours on the weekdays, more Saturday service, Sunday service, more reliable service, and then regional routes connecting communities, and of course, marketing and real-time information. We found that the most transit user need was with the seniors, individuals with disabilities, and then the carless households. We also found a big transit need when you had the presence of a college campus or a county seat. We do see a big, significant, dramatic demographic change coming in 2025, showing that that need will increase. All right, here's some details. Getting into ridership. So in that plan that we prepared for the legislative directive, we found that 100% of the need would be basically providing 18.9 million trips by the year 2025. With that goal set at hitting 90% by the year 2025, that was to provide 17 million trips. This is the ridership from 2011 until 2017. In 2017, we supported 11.8 million rides. You can see the trend down in 16 and 17, and that wasn't special to Minnesota. That was nationwide and kind of just based on the economic strength of the economy and then kind of the decreasing gas prices. So now translating those rides into service hours. So this is our service hours from 2011 through 2017 and then predicting those from 2018 up to 2025. So in order to get that 17 million rides by 2025, we also need to provide or have a goal of 1.7 million service hours. In 2017, that service hours was just shy of 1.4 million service hours. Here are the funding sources for Greater Minnesota. We have the local share, MVEST and MVLST, the general fund, and federal funds. To just give you an approximation of the percentages, local is approximately 20%, MVEST and MVLST is approximately 50%, 10% from the general fund, and then 20% federal. All right, so to achieve that goal of meeting 90% of the need by 2025, the Greater Investment Plan estimated an additional $22 million of investment required annually to get to that 17 million rides by 2025. So investing in the future, the transit systems are innovating, consolidating, and coordinating daily to achieve this goal. Some of the ideas that we're working with and exploring with the transit providers, I'll give you a couple examples here, application development, scheduling software, and then a statewide marketing resource. So these are the ideas that we're going to be exploring in the future with our transit providers to make that goal of the 17 million rides by 2025.
Thank you very much. Questions from members? Yes, Representative Tappity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for being here. If we go to the Greater Minnesota Public Transit Funding, page 8 on there, 2018 doesn't have any general fund money in that. Is that a graph issue? Is there really no general fund money in 2018 as compared to the rest of the system?
Chair.
Yes.
Representative. No glitch. We did check our math before we came, and it was a year that we were not allocated any general fund money.
Representative Tappity.
And is there, or is that just a decision that was made by the legislature? Is there some other mitigating circumstance for that, or what's the reasoning for that?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Tappity, Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. There was a fairly large balance in the Greater Minnesota Transit Assistance account at that time, and so the legislature made a decision to eliminate the general fund appropriation for 1 year as a way to address that fund balance.
One final, Tapke.
Thank you. So final question on that, is that is in place for 2019 currently and then moving forward, is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tapke, that's correct. It is now in our base funding again going forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone here? There's a Perkelson. You looked like you were getting ready to ask a question.
We're just having a little confab here, Mr. Okay. Chair. In regard to the apparent lack of funding in 2018, there was a substantial balance that was sitting around doing nothing, frankly, and we didn't feel that was appropriate. So the reduction in general fund spending really was put them in a position where they had to spend down that balance, and but we did not decrease their ongoing funding, as you can see in the chart. So I guess the message is, if you have money, use it, because if you don't use it, leaving it laying around is a bad idea because it tends to disappear.
Good point, Representative Perkelson. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that does make sense, except when you want to do long-range planning. So that's another whole other ball of wax. Mr. Chair, one of my questions actually is, I know we talk a lot about fare box recovery when we talk about the metro area transit. So could you give me a ballpark on some of your, what percentage is fare box recovery in your funding stream?
Chair, committee members?
No.
Thank you for that question. We do have very different size services with very different makeups. Some of the systems are a three-person shop. Some of the systems are, you know, fully staffed. The farebox recovery varies by system. So I couldn't give you the exact percentage of that, but it does vary greatly depending on the market.
Mr. Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to see at least some of that from maybe the larger carriers.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Mill? If not, thank you very much. Before I let the committee adjourn early, Representative Petersburg. Well, I have a couple of announcements.
Mr. Chair, maybe you're going to announce this. I was just inquiring about if you've put any finalized plans in regards to outstate.
Yes, that's exactly where I was going. Thank you. We're always tracking Representative Petersburg. So, members, I wanted you to note the following on your calendars. On Friday, February 22nd, we have a field trip to St. Cloud. And we'll leave here at approximately 8:30 and get back at approximately 5. We have a bus. We'll also be touring the new Flyer facility. And then we'll have a hearing from noon to 3 at the St. Cloud City Hall. And also, this is not 100% confirmed, but it's very likely that we'll, on Friday, March 8th, we'll be going to Mankato. And, you know, I don't know the location, but we would tentatively leave here at 9:30, get back about 4:30, and we won't have a field trip there. We'll just have the hearing at around noon, probably at the City Council or Civic Center. We're trying to finalize that location. And then I don't have a I think you should also hold Tuesday, February 26th, for an evening hearing in the Metro. But we will be sending confirmation of all of this once the times and locations are finalized. There are a lot of logistics here, but I wanted to give you at least that notice for Friday the 22nd in St. Cloud, Friday the 8th. And members, we will be hearing from these local communities, but we'll also be doing some business. We'll be passing bills, particularly, you know, for those in the St. Cloud area. I would hope that Representative O'Driscoll and Representative Wolgamont can prepare some legislation for your hometown crowd. We also have people along the Highway 14 corridor. If you want to hear your bills there, we will, accommodate you. And then finally, members, for next week, we'll be hearing four bills that are posted on Tuesday. Two of those bills will be laid over here because we don't have fiscal notes. And we're not, you know, as Representative Corkelson mentioned, it's important that we hold those bills here before we move them out. And there's two that don't, so those we can move those forward. Those are policy bills, but there are a couple of finance bills related that we will hold in our committee. Those will be just laid over. And then finally, a week from today on the 7th, we'll have some guests coming in from Georgia. Representative Petersburg and Nolan and I attended a conference in Atlanta in December, and I was very impressed with the transportation finance chair in the Georgia House of Representatives, who's done some very good bipartisan work. I think we have some similarities and differences, of course, with Georgia, but we'll hear from him and a couple of business leaders from Atlanta that are coming up. So that's a week from today, and again, no bills. That'll just be kind of an overview, informational kind of session. So, if there are no other questions, we will stand adjourned.